entirely different.
In what way?
You were fat and pale, and you were wearing different clothes.
Bastian smiled.
Fat and pale?
He asked incredulously. Are you sure it was me?
Wasn't it?
Bastian thought it over. You saw me.
I know that. But I've always been the way I am now.
Really and truly? I should know, shouldn't I? Bastian cried.
Yes, said Atreo, looking at him thoughtfully. You should know.
Maybe it was a deforming mirror.
Atreo shook his head. I don't think so.
Then how do you explain your seeing me that way?
I don't know, Atreo admitted. I only know that I wasn't mistaken.
After that, they were silent for a long while, and at length they went to sleep. As Bastian lay in his bed, the head and foot of which were made of the finest silver filigree, his conversation with Atreo ran through his head. Somehow it seemed to him that Atreo was less impressed by his victory over Hera Hunrik and even by his stay with Grogramann, since he heard that he, Bastian, was wearing the gem. And true enough, he thought, maybe his feats didn't amount to much, considering that he had the amulet to protect him. But he wanted to win Atreyu's wholehearted admiration. He thought and thought. There had to be something that no one in Fantastica could do, even with the amulet. Something of which only he, Bastian, was capable. At last it came to him. Making up stories. Time and time again he had heard it said that no one in Fantastica could create anything new. Even the voice of Ulalla had said something of the kind. And just that was his special gift. He would show Atreo that he, Bastian, was a great storyteller. He resolved to prove himself to his friend at the first opportunity, maybe the very next day. For instance, there might be a storytelling contest, and he would put all the others in the shade with his inventions. Or better still, suppose all the stories he told should come true. Hadn't Grogramann said that Fantastica was the land of stories, and that even something long past could be born again if it occurred in a story? Atreo would be amazed. And while picturing Atreo's amazement, Bastian fell asleep. The next morning, as they were enjoying a copious breakfast in the banquet hall of the palace, Silver Sage Quirquabad said, "We have decided to hold a very special sort of festival for the benefit of our guest, the Savior of Fantastica, and his friend who brought him to us. Perhaps Bastian Balthazar books, it is unknown to you that in keeping with an age-old tradition, we Amarganthians have always been the ballad singers and storytellers of Fantastica. From an early age, our children are instructed in these skills. When they grow to adulthood, they journey from country to country for several years, practicing their art for the benefit of all. Everywhere they are welcomed with joy and respect. But we have one regret. Quite frankly, our stock of stories is small, and many of us must share this little. But word has gone round, whether true or not I don't know, that you, in your world, are famous for your stories. Is that the truth?
Yes, said Bastian. They even made fun of me for it.
Silver Sage Quirquabad raised his eyebrows in disbelief. Made fun of you for telling stories that no one had ever heard? How is that possible? None of us can make up new stories. And we, my fellow citizens and I, would all be infinitely grateful if you would give us a few. Will you help us with your genius?
With pleasure, said Bastian.
After breakfast, Bastian, Atreyu, and the Silver Sage went out to the steps of Quirquabad's palace, where Falcor was already waiting for them. A large crowd had gathered, but on this occasion it included few of the outsiders who had come for the tournament, and consisted largely of Amarganthians, men, women, and children, all comely and blue-eyed, and all clad in silver. Most were carrying stringed instruments, harps, lyres, guitars, or lutes, all of silver. For almost everyone there hoped to display his art in the presence of Bastian and Atreyu. Again chairs had been put in place. Bastian sat in the middle between Quirquabad and Atreyu, and Falcor stood behind them. Quirquabad clapped his hands. When the crowd fell silent, he announced, "The great storyteller is going to grant our wish and make us a present of some new stories. Therefore, friends, give us your best to put him in the right mood." The Amarganthians all bowed low. Then the first stepped forward and began to recite. After him came another, and still others. All had fine, resonant voices and told their stories well. Some of their tales were exciting, others merry or sad, but it would take us too long to tell them here. In all, there were no more than 100 different stories. Then they began to repeat themselves. Those who came last could only tell what their predecessors had told before them. Bastian grew more and more agitated while waiting for his turn. His last night's wish had been fulfilled to the letter, and he could hardly bear the excitement of waiting to see whether everything else would come true as well. He kept casting glances at Atreyu, but Atreyu's face was impassive, showing no sign of what he might be thinking. At length, Quirquabad bade his compatriots desist, and turned to Bastian with a sigh. "I told you, Bastian Balthazar Books, that our stock of tales was small. It's not our fault. Won't you give us a few of yours?"
"I will give you all the stories I've ever told," said Bastian, "for I can always think up new ones. I told many of them to a little girl named Krista, but most I thought up only for myself. No one else has heard them. But it would take weeks and months to tell them all, and we can't stay with you that long. So I've decided to tell you a story that contains all the others in it. It's called The Story of the Library of Amarganth, and it's very short." Then, after a moment's thought, he plunged in. In the grey dawn of time, the city of Amarganth was ruled by a silver sagess named Quanna. In those long past days, Moru, the Lake of Tears, hadn't been made yet, nor was Amarganth built of the special silver that withstands the water of Moru. It was still like other cities, with houses of stone and wood, and it lay in a valley among wooded hills. Quanna had a son named Quinn, who was a great hunter. One day in the forest, Quinn caught sight of a unicorn, which had a glittering stone at the end of its horn. He killed the beast and took the stone home with him. His crime, for it is a crime to kill unicorns, brought misfortune on the city. From then on, fewer and fewer children were born to the inhabitants. If no remedy were found, the city would die out. But the unicorn couldn't be brought back to life, and no one knew what to do. Quanna, the silver sagess, sent a messenger to consult Uyulala in the southern oracle. But the southern oracle was far away. The messenger was young when he started out, but old by the time he got back. Quanna had long been dead, and her son Quinn had taken her place. He too, of course, was very old, as were all the other inhabitants. There were only 2 children left, a boy and a girl. His name was Akil, hers was Muka. The messenger reported what Uyulala's voice had revealed. The only way of preserving Amarganth was to make it the most beautiful city in all Fantastica. That alone would make amends for Quinn's crime. But to do so, the Amarganthians would need the help of the Akaris, who were the ugliest beings in Fantastica. Because they are so ugly, they weep uninterruptedly, and for that reason they are also known as the Weepers. Their streams of tears wash the special silver deep down in the earth, and from it they make the most wonderful filigree. All the Amarganthians went looking for the Akaris, but were unable to find them, for they live deep down in the earth. At length, only Akil and Mooka were left. They had grown up, and all the others had died. Together, they managed to find the Akaris and persuade them to make Amarganth the most beautiful city in Fantastica. First, the Akaris built a small filigree palace, set it on a silver barge, and moved it to the marketplace of the dead city. Then they made their streams of underground tears well up in the valley among the wooded hills. The bitter water filled the valley and became Moru, the Lake of Tears. On it, the first silver palace floated, and in the palace dwelt Akil and Mooka. But the Akaris had granted the plea of Akil and Mooka on one condition, namely that they and all their descendants should devote their lives to ballad singing and storytelling. As long as they did so, the Akaris would help them, because then their ugliness would help to create beauty. So Akil and Mooka founded a library, the famous Library of Amarganth, in which they stored up all my stories. They began with the one you have just heard, but little by little they added all those I have ever told, and in the end there were so many stories that their numerous descendants, who now inhabit the Silver City, will never come to the end of them. If Amarganth, the most beautiful city in Fantastica, is still in existence today, it is because the Akaris and the Amarganthians kept their promise to each other. Though today the Amarganthians have quite forgotten the Akaris, and the Akaris have quite forgotten the Amarganthians. Only the name of Moru, the Lake of Tears, recalls that episode from the grey dawn of history. When Bastian had finished, Silver Sage Quirquabad rose slowly from his chair.
"Bastian Balthazar Books," he said, smiling blissfully. "You have given us more than a story, and more than all the stories in the world. You have given us our own history. Now we know where Moru and the silver ships and palaces on it came from. Now we know why we have always, from the earliest times, been a people of ballad singers and storytellers. And best of all, we know what is in that great round building in the middle of the city, which none of us, since the founding of Amarganth, has ever entered, because it has always been locked. It contains our greatest treasure, and we never knew it. It contains the Library of Amarganth." Bastian himself could hardly believe it. Everything in his story had become reality. Or had it always been? Grogramon would probably have said, "Both." In any event, he was eager to see all this with his own eyes. "Where is this building?" he asked.
"I will show you," said Quirquabad. And turning to the crowd, he cried, "Come along, all of you. Perhaps we shall be favored with more wonders."
A long procession, headed by the Silver Sage, Bastian, and Atreyu, moved over the gangplanks connecting the silver ships with one another, and finally stopped outside a large building, which rested on a circular ship, and was shaped like a huge silver box. The outside walls were smooth, without ornaments or windows. It had only one large door, and that door was locked. In the center of the smooth silver door, there was a stone set in a kind of ring. It looked like a piece of common glass. Over it, the following inscription could be read: "Removed from the unicorn's horn, I lost my light.
I shall keep the door locked until my light is rekindled by him who calls me by name. For him I will shine 100 years. I will guide him in the dark depths of Yorzmin-Rud. But if he says my name a second time from the end to the beginning, I will glow in one moment with the light of 100 years. None of us can interpret this inscription, said Quirquabad. None of us knows what the words Yorzmin-Rud mean. None of us to this day has ever discovered the stone's name, though we have all tried time and again. For we can only use names that already exist in Fantastica. And since these are all names of other things, none of us has made the stone glow or opened the door. Can you find the name, Bastian Balthazar Books? A deep, expectant silence fell on the Amarganthians and non-Amarganthians alike.
Alts are here! Cried Bastian.
In that moment the stone glowed bright and jumped straight from its setting into Bastian's hand. The door opened. A gasp of amazement arose from 1,000 throats. Holding the glowing stone in his hand, Bastian entered the building, followed by Quirquabad and Atreyu. The crowd surged in behind them. It was dark in the large circular room, and Bastian held the stone high. Though brighter than a candle, it was not enough to light the whole room, but showed only that the walls were lined with tier upon tier of books. Attendants appeared with lamps. In the bright light, it could be seen that the walls of books were divided into sections, bearing signs such as funny stories, serious stories, exciting stories, and so on. In the center of the circular room, the floor was inlaid with an inscription so large that no one could fail to see it. Library of the Collected Works of Bastian Balthazar Books. Atreyu looked around in amazement. Bastian saw to his delight that his friend was overcome with admiration.
Is it true?
Asked Atreyu, pointing at the silver shelves all around.
That you made up all these stories?
Yes, said Bastian, slipping Altzahir into his pocket. Atreyu could only stand and gape.
I just can't understand it, he said.
The Amarganthians had flung themselves on the books and were leafing through them or reading to one another. Some sat down on the floor and began to learn passages by heart. News of the great event spread through the whole city like wildfire. As Bastian and Atreyu were leaving the library, they ran into Hukrion, Husbald, and Hudorn.
Sir Bastian, said the red-haired Husbald, evidently the deftest of the three, not only with the sword, but with his tongue as well. We have heard about your incomparable gifts, and humbly pray you. Take us into your service, and let us accompany you on your further travels. Each one of us longs to acquire a story of his own, and though you surely have no need of our protection, you may derive some advantage from the service of 3 such able and willing knights. Will you have us?
Gladly, said Bastian. Anyone would be proud of such companions.
The 3 knights wished to swear fealty by Bastian's sword, but he held them back.
Sikander, he explained, is a magic sword. No one can touch it without mortal peril, unless he is eaten, drunk, and bathed in the fire of the many-colored death.
So they had to content themselves with a friendly handshake.
What has become of Hero Hunrek? Bastian asked.
He's a broken man, said Hukrion.
Because of his lady,
Hudorn added.
Perhaps you can do something to help him, said Husbald.
All 5 of them went to the inn where they had stopped on their arrival in Amarganth, and where Bastian had brought Yika to the stable. When they entered, one man was sitting there, bent over the table, his hands buried in his fair hair. The man was Hunrek. Evidently he had had a change of armor in his luggage, for the outfit he was now wearing
was rather simpler than the one that had been cut to pieces the day before. In response to Bastian's greeting, he merely stared. His eyes were rimmed with red. When Bastian asked leave to sit down with him, he shrugged his shoulders, nodded, and sank back in his chair. Before him on the table was a sheet of paper, which looked as if it had been many times crumpled and smoothed out again.
"Can you forgive me?" said Bastian.
Hero Hunrek shook his head.
"It's all over for me," he said mournfully. "Here, read it."
He pushed the note across the table, and Bastian read it.
"I want only the best. You have failed me. Farewell." "From Princess Oglamar?" Bastian asked.
Hero Hunrek nodded.
"Immediately after our contest, she mounted her palfrey and rode off to the ferry. God knows where she is now. I'll never see her again."
"Can't you overtake her?"
"What for?"
"Maybe she'll change her mind."
Hero Hunrek gave a bitter laugh.
"You don't know Princess Oglamar," he said. "I trained more than 10 years to acquire my different skills. With iron discipline, I avoided everything that could have impaired my physique. I fenced with the greatest fencing masters and wrestled with the greatest wrestlers until I could beat them all. I can run faster than a horse, jump higher than a deer. I am best at everything, or rather I was until yesterday. At the start, she wouldn't honor me with a glance, but little by little, my accomplishments aroused her interest. I had every reason to hope, and now I see it was all in vain. How can I live without hope?"
"Maybe," Bastian suggested, "you should forget Princess Oglamar. There must be others you could love just as much."
"No," said Hero Hunrek. "I love Princess Oglamar just because she won't be satisfied with anything but the greatest."
"I see," said Bastian. "That makes it difficult. What could you do? Maybe you could take up a different trade. How about singing or poetry?"
Hunrek seemed rather annoyed.
"No," he said flatly. "I'm a hero, and that's that. I can't change my profession, and I don't want to. I am what I am."
"I see," said Bastian.
All were silent for a time. The three knights cast sympathetic glances at Hero Hunrek. They understood his plight. Finally, Husbald cleared his throat and turned to Bastian.
"Sebastian," he said, "I think you could help him."
Bastian looked at Atreyu, but Atreyu had put on his impenetrable face.
"A hero like Hunrek," said Hudorn, "is really to be pitied in a world without monsters. See what I mean?"
No, Bastian didn't see. Not yet, at any rate.
"Monsters," said
Hukrion, winking at Bastian and stroking his huge moustache.
"Monsters are indispensable if a hero is to be a hero."
At last, Bastian understood.
"Listen to me, Hero Hunrek," he said. "When I suggested giving your heart to another lady, I was only putting your love to the test. The truth is that Princess Oglamar needs your help right now, and that no one else can save her."
Hero Hunrek pricked up his ears.
"Is that true, Sebastian?"
"It's true, as you will soon see. Only a few minutes ago, Princess Oglamar was seized and kidnapped."
"By whom?"
"By one of the most terrible monsters that have ever existed in Fantastica, the dragon Smaug. She was riding across a clearing in the woods when the monster saw her from the air, swooped down, lifted her off her palfrey's back, and carried her away."
Hunrek jumped up. His eyes flashed. His cheeks were aglow. He clapped his hands for joy.
But then the light went out of his eyes, and he sat down,
"That's not possible," he said. "There are no more dragons anywhere."
"You forget, Hero Hunrik, that I come from far away, from much farther than you have ever been."
"That's true," said Atreyu, joining in for the first time.
"And this monster really carried her away?"
Hero Hunrik cried.
Then he pressed both hands to his heart and sighed. "Oh, my adored Oglema, how you must be suffering!
But never fear, your knight is coming. He is on his way. Tell me, what must I do? Where must I go?"
"Far, far from here," Bastian began, "there's a country called Morgul, or the Land of the Cold Fire, because flames there are colder than ice. How you are to reach that country I can't tell you. You must find out for yourself. In the center of Morgul there is a petrified forest called Wadgarbe, and in the center of that petrified forest stands the leaden castle of Ragar. It is surrounded by three moats. The first is full of arsenic, the second of steaming nitric acid, and the third is swarming with scorpions as big as your feet. There are no bridges across them, for the lord of the leaden castle is Smerg, the winged monster. His wings are made of slimy skin, and their spread is 100 feet. When he isn't flying, he stands on his hind legs like a gigantic kangaroo. He has the body of a mangy rat and the tail of a scorpion with a sting at the end of it. The merest touch of that sting is fatal. He has the hind legs of a giant grasshopper. His forelegs, however, which look small and shriveled, resemble the hands of a small child. But don't let them fool you. There's a deadly power in those hands. He can pull in his long neck as a snail does its feelers. There are 3 heads on it. One is large and looks like the head of a crocodile. From its mouth he can spit icy fire. But where a crocodile has its eyes, it has 2 protuberances. These are extra heads. One resembles the head of an old man. With it he can see and hear. But he talks with the second head, which has the wrinkled face of an old woman." While listening to this description, Hero Hunrik went pale.
"What was this monster's name?" he asked.
"Smerg," Bastian repeated. "He has been wreaking his mischief for 1,000 years, because that's how old he is. It's always a beautiful maiden that he kidnaps, and she has to keep house for him until the end of her days. When she dies, he kidnaps another."
"Why haven't I ever heard of this dragon?"
"Smerg flies incredibly far and fast. Up to now, he has always chosen other parts of Fantastica for his raids. Besides, they only happen once in every 50 years or so."
"Hasn't any of these maidens ever been rescued?"
"No, that would take a very special sort of hero."
These words brought the color back to Hero Hunrik's cheeks. And remembering what he had learned about dragons, he asked,
"Has this Smerg a vulnerable spot?"
"Oh," said Bastian, "I almost forgot. In the bottommost cellar of Ragar Castle, there's a lead axe. It's the only weapon Smerg can be killed with, so naturally he guards it well. You have to cut off the 2 smaller heads with it."
"How do you know all this?" asked Hero Hunrik.
Bastian didn't have to answer, for at that moment cries of terror were heard in the street.
"A dragon! A monster! Up there in the sky! Horrible! He's coming this way! Run for your lives! No! He's already got somebody!" Hero Hunrik rushed out into the street, and all the others followed. Up in the sky, something that looked like a giant bat was flapping its enormous wings. For a moment, as it came closer, he looked exactly as Bastian had just made him up. And in his 2 shriveled, but oh so dangerous, little arms, he was clutching a young lady, who was screaming and struggling with all her might.
"Hunrik!" she screamed. "Hunrik! Hunrik, my hero! Help!"
And then they were gone.
Hunrek had already brought his black stallion from the stable and boarded one of the silver ferries that crossed to the mainland.
"Faster! Faster!" he could be heard shouting at the ferryman. "I'll give you anything you ask, but hurry!"
Bastian looked after him and muttered, "I only hope I haven't made it too hard for him." Atreyu cast a sidelong glance at Bastian. Then he said softly, "Maybe we should get going too."
"Going where?"
"I brought you to Fantastica," said Atreyu. "I think I ought to help you to find the way back to your own world." "You mean to go back sooner or later, don't you?"
"Oh," said Bastian, "I hadn't thought about it."
"But you're right, Atreyu."
"Yes, of course you are."
"You saved Fantastica," Atreyu went on, "and it seems to me you've received quite a lot in return. I have a hunch you're aching to go home and make your own world well again. Or is there something that keeps you here?"
Bastian, who had forgotten that he hadn't always been strong, handsome, and brave, replied, "No, I can't think of anything."
Atreyu gave his friend a thoughtful look and said, "It may be a long, hard journey. Who knows?"
"Yes," Bastian agreed. "Who knows?"
"We can start right now if you like."
Then the three knights had a short, friendly argument, because each claimed the privilege of giving Bastian his horse. Bastian soon settled the matter by asking them for Yika, their pack mule. Of course, they thought her unworthy of Bastian, but he insisted, and in the end they gave in. While the knights were making ready for the journey, Bastian and Atreyu went to Quirquabad's palace to thank the Silver Sage for his hospitality and bid him goodbye. Falcor, the Luck Dragon, who was waiting for Atreyu outside the palace, was delighted to hear they were leaving. Cities just didn't appeal to him, even if they were as beautiful as Amaganth. Silver Sage Quirquabad was deep in a book he had borrowed from the Bastian Balthazar Books library.
"I'm sorry you can't stay longer," he said rather absently. "It's not every day that a great author like you comes to see us, but at least we have your works to console us."
Whereupon they took their leave. After seating himself on Falcor's back, Atreyu asked Bastian, "Didn't you want to ride, Falcor?"
"Later," said Bastian. "Now Yika is waiting for me, and I've given her my promise."
"Then we'll wait for you on the mainland," cried Atreyu.
The Luck Dragon rose into the air and was soon out of sight. When Bastian returned to the inn, the three knights were ready. They had taken the pack saddle off Yika and replaced it with a richly ornamented riding saddle. Yika didn't learn why until Bastian came over and whispered in her ear, "You belong to me now, Yika." As the ferry carried them away from the Silver City, the old pack mule's cries of joy resounded over the bitter waters of Moru, the Lake of Tears.
As for Hero Hunrik, he actually succeeded in reaching Morgul, the land of the Cold Fire. He ventured into the petrified forest of Wat Garbe, crossed the three moats of Rhaegar Castle, found the lead axe, and slew the dragon Smerg. Then he brought Oglamar back to her father. At that point she would gladly have married him, but by then he didn't want her any more. That, however, is another story, and shall be told another time. 18. The Akaris. Rain was coming down in buckets. The black, wet clouds hung so low that they seemed almost to graze the heads of the riders. Then big, sticky snowflakes began to fall, and in the end it was snowing and raining in one. The wind was so strong that even the horses had to brace themselves against it. The riders' cloaks were soaked through and flapped heavily against the backs of the beasts. For the last 3 days they had been riding over a desolate, high plateau. The weather had been getting steadily worse, and the ground was a mixture of mud and sharp stones that made for hard going. Here and there the monotony of the landscape was broken by clumps of bushes or of stunted, wind-bowed trees. Bastian, who rode in the lead on his mule Yika, was fairly well off
with his glittering silver mantle, which, though light and thin, proved to be remarkably warm and shed water like a duck. The low-slung body of Hukrian the Strong almost vanished in his thick blue woolen coat. The delicately built Husbald had pulled his great loden hood over his red hair, and Hudorn's grey canvas cloak clung to his gaunt frame. Yet in their rather crude way, the three knights were of good cheer. They hadn't expected their adventure with Sebastian to be a Sunday stroll. Now and then, with more spirit than art, they sang into the storm, sometimes singly and sometimes in chorus. Their favourite song seemed to be one that began with the words,
"When that I was and a little tiny boy, with hey ho the wind and the rain. When that I was and a little tiny boy, with hey ho the wind and the rain."
As they explained, this had been sung by a human who had visited Fantastica long years before, name of Shakespeare, or something of the sort. The only one in the group who didn't seem to mind the cold and the rain was Atreyu. On Falkor's back, he rode high above the clouds, flying far ahead to reconnoiter and rejoining the company from time to time to report on what he had seen. They all, even the Luck Dragon, believed they were looking for the road that would take Bastian back to his world. Bastian thought so too. He himself didn't realize that he had agreed to Atreyu's suggestion only to oblige his friend, and that this wasn't what he really wanted. But the geography of Fantastica is determined by wishes, which may or may not be conscious. And since it was Bastian who led the way, they were actually going deeper and deeper into Fantastica, heading for the ivory tower at its very center. What the consequences for him would be, he wouldn't learn until much later. For the present, neither he nor his companions had any idea where they were going. Bastian's thoughts were busy with a different problem. On the second day of their journey, in the forests surrounding the Lake of Tears, he had seen unmistakable traces of the dragon Smaug. Some of the trees had been turned to stone, no doubt by contact with the monster's ice-cold fire, and the prints of the giant grasshopper feet were clearly discernible. Atreyu, who was skilled in woodcraft, had seen other tracks as well, those of Hero Hunrek's horse, which meant that Hunrek was close on the dragon's heels.
"That doesn't really thrill me," said Falkor, rolling his ruby-red eyes. "Monster or not, this Smaug is a relative of mine, a distant one, to be sure, but a relative all the same."
He was only half in jest. They had not followed Hero Hunrek's track, but had taken a different direction, since their supposed aim was to find Bastian's way home. And now Bastian was asking himself, had it really been such a good idea to invent a dragon for Hero Hunrek? True, Hunrek had needed a chance to show his mettle, but was it certain that he would win? What if Smaug killed him? And what about Princess Oglemar? Yes, of course she had been haughty, but was that a reason for getting her into such a fix? And on top of all that, how was he to know what further damage Smaug might do in Fantastica? Without stopping to think, Bastian had created an unpredictable menace. It would be there long after he was gone, and quite possibly kill or maim any number of innocents. As he knew, Moonchild drew no distinction between good and evil, beautiful and ugly. To her mind, all the creatures in Fantastica were equally important and worthy of consideration. But had he, Bastian, the right to take the same attitude? And above all, did he wish to? No, Bastian said to himself. He had no wish to go down in the history of Fantastica as a creator of monsters and horrors. How much finer it would be to become famous for his unselfish goodness, to be a shining model for all, to be revered as the good human or the great benefactor. Yes, that was what he wanted. The country became mountainous, and Atreyu, returning from a reconnaissance flight, reported that a few miles ahead he had sighted a glen which seemed to offer shelter from the wind. In fact, if his eyes had not deceived him, there were several caves round about where they could take refuge from the rain and snow. It was already late afternoon, high time to find suitable quarters for the night. So all the others were delighted at Atreo's news and spurred their mounts on. They were making their way through a valley, possibly a dried-out riverbed, enclosed in mountains which grew higher as the travellers advanced. Some 2 hours later, they reached the glen, and true enough, there were several caves in the surrounding cliffs. They chose the largest and made themselves as comfortable as they could. The three knights gathered brushwood and branches that had been blown down by the storm, and soon they had a splendid fire going in the cave. The wet cloaks were spread out to dry, the beasts were brought in and unsaddled, and even Falcor, who ordinarily preferred to spend the night in the open, curled up at the back of the cave. All in all, it wasn't such a bad place to be in. While Hudurn the Enduring tried to roast a big chunk of meat over the fire, and the others watched him eagerly, Atreo turned to Bastion and said, "Tell us some more about Krista."
"About what?" Bastion asked.
"Your friend Krista, the little girl you told your stories to."
"I don't know any little girl by that name," said Bastion. "And what makes you think I told her stories?"
Once again, Atreo had that thoughtful look. "Back in your world," he said slowly, "you used to tell lots of stories, some to her and some to yourself."
"How do you know that, Atreo?"
"You said so yourself, in Amarganth. You also said that people made fun of you for it."
Bastion stared into the fire. "That's true," he muttered. "I did say that. But I don't know why. I can't remember."
It all seemed very strange. Atreo exchanged glances with Falcor and nodded gravely, as though something one of them had said had now been proved true. But he said nothing more. Evidently he didn't wish to discuss such matters in front of the three knights.
"The meat's done," Hudorn announced.
He cut off a chunk for each one, and they all began to eat.
"Done" was a gross exaggeration. The meat was charred on the outside and raw on the inside, but under the circumstances there was no point in being picky and choosy. For a while they were all busy chewing. Then Atreo said to Bastion,
"Tell us how you came to Fantastica."
"You know all about that," said Bastion. "It was you who brought me to the childlike empress."
"I mean before that," said Atreo. "In your world. Where did you live, and how did it all happen?"
Then Bastion told how he had stolen the book from Mr. Coriander, how he had carried it off to the schoolhouse attic and begun to read. When he came to Atreu's great quest, Atreu motioned him to stop. He didn't seem interested in what the book said about him. What interested him in the extreme was the how and why of Bastion's visit to Mr. Coriander, and of his flight to the attic of the schoolhouse. Bastion racked his brains, but about those things he could remember nothing more. He had forgotten everything connected with the fact that he had once been fat and weak and cowardly. His memory had been broken into bits, and the bits seemed as vague and far away as if they had concerned an entirely different person. Atreo asked for other memories, and Bastion spoke about the days when his mother was still alive, about his father and his home, about school and the town he lived in, as much as he remembered. The three knights had fallen asleep, and Bastion was still talking. It surprised him that Atreo should take such an interest in the most everyday happenings. Maybe it was because of the way Atreo listened that these everyday things took on a new interest for Bastion, as though they contained a secret magic that he had never noticed before. At last he ran out of memories. It was late in the night, the fire had died down. The three knights were snoring softly. Atreo sat there with his inscrutable look, as though deep in thought. Bastion stretched out, wrapped himself in his silver mantle, and had almost fallen asleep, when Atreo said softly, "It's because of Orin."
Bastian propped his head on his hand and looked sleepily at his friend.
What do you mean by that?
The gem, said Atreo, as though talking to himself, doesn't work the same with humans as with us.
What makes you think that?
The amulet gives you great power. It makes all your wishes come true. But at the same time, it takes something away. Your memory of your world.
Bastian thought it over. He didn't feel as if anything had been taken away from him.
Grogramon told me to find out what I really wanted, and the inscription on Orin says the same thing. But for that, I have to go from one wish to the next without ever skipping any. That's why I need the gem.
Yes, said Atreo. It gives you the means, but it takes away your purpose.
Oh, well, said Bastian, undismayed. Moonchild must have known what she was doing when she gave me the amulet.
You worry too much, Atreo. I'm sure Orin isn't a trap.
No, said Atreo. I don't think so either.
And after a while, he added, Anyway, it's good we're looking for the way back to your world.
We are, aren't we?
Oh, yes, said Bastian, already half asleep. In the middle of the night, he was awakened by a strange sound. He had no idea what it was. The fire had gone out, and he was lying in total darkness. Then he felt Atreo's hand on his shoulder and heard him whisper, What's that?
I don't know, Bastian whispered back.
They crept to the mouth of the cave and listened. A great many creatures seemed to be trying to fight back their sobs. There was nothing human about it, and it didn't sound like animals in pain. Starting as a whisper, it swelled to a sigh, then ebbed and rose. Never had Bastian heard anything so mournful.
If at least we could see something, Atreo whispered.
Wait, said Bastian. I've got Alza here.
He took the glittering stone from his pocket and held it high. It gave hardly more light than a candle, but in its faint glow, the friends saw enough to make their skin crawl with horror. The whole glen was alive with hideous foot-long worms who looked as if they had been wrapped in soiled rags. Slimy little limbs protruded from the folds in their skin. At one end, two lidless eyes peered out from under the rags, and from every eye flowed tears, thousands of tears. The whole glen was wet with them. The moment the light from Altsahir hit them, the creatures froze, and the friends were able to see what they had been doing. At the center of the glen stood a tower of the finest silver filigree, more beautiful and more valuable than any building Bastian had seen in Amalgam. Some of the worm-like creatures had evidently been climbing about on the tower, joining its innumerable parts. But at present they all stood motionless, staring at the light of Altsahir. A ghoulish whisper passed over the glen.
Alas, alas, what light has fallen on our ugliness? Whose eye has seen us? Cruel intruder, whoever you may be, have mercy. Take that light away.
Bastian stood up.
I am Bastian Balthazar Books. Who are you?
We are the Akaris. We are the unhappiest beings in all Fantastica.
Bastian said nothing and looked in dismay at Atreo.
Then, he said, it's you who created Amalganth, the most beautiful city in Fantastica?
Yes, the creatures cried, but take that light away, and don't look at us. Have mercy.
And with your weeping, you made Moru the Lake of Tears?
Master, they groaned, it's true, but we'll die of shame and horror if you make us stand in this light. Why must you add to our torment? We've never done anything to you.
Bastian put Altsahir back in his pocket, and again the night was black as pitch.
Thank you,
cried the mournful voices. "Thank you for your merciful kindness."
"I want to talk with you," said Bastian. "I want to help you." He was almost sick with disgust, but he felt very sorry for the poor things. It was clear to him that they were the creatures he had mentioned in his story about the origin of Amaganth. But here again, he couldn't be sure whether they had always been there, or whether they owed their existence to him. In the latter case, he was responsible for their misery. But either way, he was determined to help them.
"Oh, no," the plaintive voices whimpered. "No one can help us."
"I can," said Bastian. "I have Orin." At that, they all seemed to stop weeping at once. "Where have you come from?" Bastian asked.
A chorus of many voices whispered, "We live in the lightless depths of the earth to hide our ugliness from the sun, and there we weep all day and all night. Our tears wash the indestructible silver out of the bedrock, and from it we spin the filigree you have seen. On the darkest nights we mount to the surface, and these caves are our coming out places. Up here we join together the sections we've made down below. We've come tonight because it was dark enough for us to work without seeing one another. We work to make amends to the world for our ugliness, and that comforts us a little."
"But you're not to blame for your ugliness," said Bastian.
"Oh, there are different ways of being to blame," the Akaris replied, "in what you do, in what you think. We're to blame for just living."
"How can I help you?" Bastian asked. He felt so sorry for them that he could hardly hold back his own tears.
"Ah, great benefactor," the Akaris cried, "you've got Orin. With Orin you can save us. We have only one thing to ask of you. Give us different bodies."
"Don't worry," said Bastian, "I will. Here's my wish, that you shall fall asleep, that when you wake up, you shall crawl out of your skins and turn into bright-coloured butterflies, that you shall be light-hearted and happy, and that beginning tomorrow, you shall no longer be the Akaris, the everlasting weepers, but the Shlamoofs, the everlasting laughers." Bastian awaited their answer, but no sound came from the darkness.
"They've fallen asleep," Atreyu whispered.
The two friends went back into their cave. Husbald, Hudorn, and Hukrion were still snoring gently. They had slept through the whole incident. Bastian lay down. He was extremely pleased with himself. Soon all Fantastica would learn of the good deed he had done. It had really been unselfish, since no one could claim that he had wished anything for himself. There would be nothing to mar the glory of his goodness.
"What do you think, Atreyu?" he whispered.
Atreyu was silent for a while. Then he replied,
"I only wonder what it may have cost you."
Not until somewhat later, after Atreyu had fallen asleep, did it dawn on Bastian that his friend had been referring not to his self-abnegation, but to his loss of memory. But he gave the matter no further thought, and fell asleep in joyful anticipation of the morrow. The next morning the three knights woke him up with their cries of amazement.
"Would you look at that! My word, even my old mare is giggling!"
They were standing in the mouth of the cave, and Atreyu was with them. But Atreyu wasn't laughing. Bastian got up and went out. The whole glen was crawling and flitting and tumbling with the most comical little creatures he had ever seen. They all had brightly coloured butterfly wings on their backs, and were wearing the weirdest outfits, some checkered, some striped, some ringed, some dotted. All their clothes looked either too loose or too tight too big or too small, and they were pieced together every which way. Nothing was right, and there were patches all over, even on the wings. No two of these creatures were alike. They had faces like clowns, splotched with every imaginable colour, little round red noses, or absurdly long ones, and enormous rubbery mouths. Some wore top hats, others peaked caps. Some had only three brick-red tufts of hair, and some had shiny bald heads. Most were sitting or hopping about on the delicate filigree tower, or dangling from it doing gymnastics, and in general doing their best to wreck it. Bastian ran out to them. "Hey, you guys," he shouted, "cut that out! You can't do that!" The creatures stopped and looked down at him. One at the very top of the tower asked, "What did he say?" And one from further down replied, "The Whatchamacallim says we can't do this." "Why does he say we can't do it?" asked a third. "Because you just can't," Bastian screamed. "You can't just smash everything up." "The Whatchamacallim says we can't smash everything up," the first butterfly clown informed the others. "We can too," said another, tearing a big chunk out of the tower. Hopping about like a lunatic, the first called down to Bastian, "We can too!" The tower swayed and creaked alarmingly. "Hey, what are you doing?" Bastian shouted. He was angry and he was frightened, but at the same time he had all he could do to keep from laughing. The first butterfly clown turned to his companions. "The Whatchamacallim wants to know what we're doing." "What are we doing?" asked another. "We're having fun," said a third. "But the tower will collapse if you don't stop," Bastian screamed. "The Whatchamacallim," the first clown informed the others, "says the tower will collapse if we don't stop." "So what?" said another. And the first called down, "So what?" Bastian was speechless, and before he could find a suitable answer, all the butterfly clowns on the tower began to do a sort of aerial round dance. But instead of holding hands, they grabbed one another by the legs or collars, while some simply whirled head over heels through the air, and they all bellowed and laughed. The act that the winged creatures were putting on was so light-hearted and so comical that Bastian gave up trying to hold back his laughter. "But you can't do that," he called to them. "The Akaris made it, and it's beautiful." The first butterfly clown turned back to the others. "The Whatchamacallim says we can't do it." "We can do anything that's not forbidden," cried another, turning somersaults in the air. "And who's going to forbid us? We're the Shlamoofs." "Who's going to forbid us anything?" all cried in chorus. "We're the Shlamoofs." "I am," cried Bastian. "The Whatchamacallim," the first clown explained to the others, "says I." "You?" said the others. "How can you forbid us anything?" "No," said the first, "not I. The Whatchamacallim says he." "Why does the Whatchamacallim say he?" the others wanted to know. "And who is he saying he to in the first place?" "Who are you saying he to?" the first butterfly clown called down to Bastian. "I didn't say he," Bastian screamed, half fuming, half laughing. "I said I forbid you to wreck this tower."
"He forbids us," said the first clown to the others, "to wreck this tower."
"Who does?" inquired one who had just turned up from the far end of the glen.
"The Whatchamacallim," the others replied.
"I don't know any Whatchamacallim," said the newcomer. "Who is he anyway?"
The first sang out,
"Hey, Whatchamacallim, who are you anyway?"
"I'm not a Whatchamacallim," said Bastian, who by then was moderately angry. "I'm Bastian Balthazar Books, and I turned you into Shlamoofs so you wouldn't have to cry and moan the whole time. Last night you were still miserable Akaris. It wouldn't hurt to show your benefactor some respect." The Shlamoofs all stopped hopping and dancing at once and stood gaping at Bastian. A breathless silence fell.
"What did the Whatchamacallim say?"
whispered a butterfly clown at the edge of the crowd. But his next-door neighbour cracked him on the head so hard that his hat slid down over his eyes and ears, and all the others went, "Psst!"
"Would you be so kind as to repeat all that very slowly and distinctly?"
the first butterfly clown requested.
"I am your benefactor," cried Bastian.
This threw the Schlemoofs into an incredible state of agitation. One passed the word on to the next, and in the end the innumerable creatures, who up until then had been scattered all over the glen, gathered into a knot around Bastian, shouting in one another's ears.
"Did you hear that? He's our benefactor. His name is Nastibian Baltabooks. No, it's Booksian Bannernectar. Rubbish, it's Saratit Booksibem. No, it's Baldrian Hicks. Schlucks. Babbletran Billy Scooter. Nix, Flax, Trix."
Beside themselves with enthusiasm, they shook hands all around, tipped their hats to one another, and raised great clouds of dust by slapping one another on the back or belly.
"We're so lucky!" they cried. "Three cheers for Booksy Factor Zanzibar Bastel Ben!"
Screaming and laughing, the whole great swarm shot upward and whirled away. The hubbub died down in the distance. Bastian stood there, hardly knowing what his right name was. By that time, he wasn't so sure he had really done a good deed. 19. The Travelling Companions. Sunbeams were fighting their way through the cloud cover as the travellers started out that morning. At last, the rain and wind had let up. In the course of the morning, the travellers ran into two or three sudden showers, but then there was a marked improvement in the weather, and it seemed to grow warmer by the minute. The three knights were in a merry mood. They laughed and joked and played all sorts of tricks on one another. But Bastian seemed quiet and out of sorts as he rode ahead on his mule, and the knights had far too much respect for him to break in on his thoughts. The rocky, high plateau over which they were riding seemed endless, but little by little the trees became larger and more frequent. Atreyu had noticed Bastian's bad humour. When he and Falcor started on their usual reconnaissance flight, he asked the Luck Dragon what he could do to cheer his friend up. Falcor rolled his ruby-red eyeballs and answered, "That's easy. Didn't he want to ride on me?" When, sometime later, the little band rounded a jutting cliff, they found Atreyu and the Luck Dragon lying comfortably in the sun. Bastian looked at them in amazement. "Are you tired?" he asked.
"Not at all," said Atreyu. "I just wanted to ask if you'd let me ride Yiga for a while. I've never ridden a mule. It must be wonderful, because you never seem to get sick of it." "I'll lend you my old Falcor in return."
Bastian flushed with pleasure. "Is that true, Falcor?" he asked. "You wouldn't mind carrying me?"
"Of course not, all-powerful Sultan," said the dragon with a wink. "Hop on and hold tight."
Without touching the ground, Bastian vaulted directly from mule to dragonback and clutched the silvery white mane as Falcor took off. Bastian hadn't forgotten how Grogramon had carried him through the Desert of Colors, but riding a white Luck Dragon was something else again. If sweeping over the ground on the back of the fiery lion had been like a cry of ecstasy, this gentle rising and falling as the dragon adjusted his movements to the air currents was like a song, now soft and sweet, now triumphant with power. Especially when Falcor was looping the loop, when his mane, his fangs, and the long fringes on his limbs flashed through the air like white flames, it seemed to Bastian that the winds were singing in chorus. Toward noon, they sighted the others and landed. The ground party had pitched camp beside a brook in a sunlit meadow. There was flatbread to eat, and a kettle of soup was cooking over a wood fire. The horses and the mule were grazing nearby. When the meal was over, the three knights decided to go hunting, for supplies, especially of meat, were running low. They had heard the cry of pheasants in the thicket, and there seemed to be hares as well. Knowing the greenskins to be great hunters, they asked Atreyu to join them, but he declined. Thereupon the knights took their long bows, buckled on their quivers full of arrows, and went off to the woods. Atreyu, Valcor, and Bastion stayed behind. After a short silence, Atreyu suggested, "How about telling us a little more about your world, Bastion?" "What would interest you?" Bastion asked. Atreyu turned to the Luck Dragon. "What do you say, Falcor?"
"I'd like to hear something about the children in your school," said the dragon.
Bastion seemed bewildered. "What children?" he asked.
"The ones who made fun of you," said Falcor.
"Children who made fun of me?" Bastion repeated. "I don't know of any children, and I'm sure no child would have dared to make fun of me."
Atreyu broke in. "But you must remember that you went to school."
"Yes," said Bastion thoughtfully. "I remember school."
"Yes, that's right."
Atreyu and Falcor exchanged glances. "I was afraid of that," Atreyu muttered.
"Afraid of what?"
"You've lost some more of your memory," said Atreyu gravely. "This time it came of changing the Akaris into Shlamoofs. You shouldn't have done that."
"Bastion Balthazar books," said the Luck Dragon,
and his tone seemed almost stern.
"If my advice means anything to you, stop using the power that Orin gives you. If you don't, you're likely to lose your last memories. And without memory, how will you ever find your way back to where you came from?"
"To tell the truth," said Bastion, "I don't want to go back anymore."
Atreyu was horrified.
"But you have to go back. You have to go back and straighten out your world so humans will start coming to Fantastica again. Otherwise Fantastica will disappear sooner or later, and all our trouble will have been wasted."
At that point, Bastion felt rather offended.
"But I'm still here," he protested. "It's been only a little while since I gave Moonchild her new name."
Atreyu could think of nothing to say. But then Falcor spoke up.
"Now," he said, "I see why we haven't made the slightest progress in finding Bastion's way back. If he himself doesn't want to..."
"Bastion," said Atreyu almost pleadingly, "isn't there anything that draws you? Something you love? Don't you ever think of your father, who must be waiting for you and worrying about you?"
Bastion shook his head.
"I don't think so. Maybe he's even glad to be rid of me."
Atreyu looked at his friend in horror.
"The way you two carry on," said Bastion bitterly, "you almost sound as if you wanted to get rid of me too." "What do you mean by that?" asked Atreyu, with a catch in his voice.
"Well," said Bastion, "you seem to have only one thing on your minds, getting me out of Fantastica as quickly as possible."
Atreyu looked at Bastion and slowly shook his head. For a long while, none of them said a word. Already, Bastion was beginning to regret his angry words.